Okay. So let me say by way of background that, I know this book really well. But every time I come to it, there's something new that I'm learning and some new issue that comes up. And what's been really interesting for me in this last go-round, as we've been doing this over these last few weeks, is this sense that we're focusing on one point, which is that we have this kind of wrong-headed understanding of time, which has to do with linear time. But the way it's presented in dynamics, I think there's a lot more, I don't know how to say it. It's not enough to say, we have this wrong view of time as being linear and unfolding from moment to moment. Dynamics is really giving us a deeper look into the structure of time as we usually understand it and what the alternative is. But because it has that one single theme, you could say, I have had the feeling sometimes that, I get a little impatient. I say, well, I know this already. I mean, I don't know it in terms of my own direct experience necessarily, but, this is just another way of making the same point again. I have that reaction. And yet, what I have realized in going through this material, is that there's something really fundamental that I don't know, and I'm kind of assuming that this is true for everybody, and that is that although we can tune in to time's dynamic, and that's what we've been working with really over the last several weeks, we tend only to be able to do it for a limited period of time. And it's not the same thing that comes up in meditation. William James, who of course was not writing about meditation, but was writing about our ability to maintain focus or maintain awareness, wrote that about the maximum length of time that we can focus on one thing is 3 seconds. Now, in meditation, And it would certainly be helpful in TSK, in meditation you cultivate the ability, in traditional shamatha meditation, you cultivate the ability to stay focused on something for a longer period of time, until ultimately you get to the point where you can just keep the object of focus for as long as you want. But that's not at all what I'm talking about, or I think what the TSK books are talking about. The issue here is whatever comes up in your experience, to be able to stay with it. It's kind of like it's kind of like riding a wild horse, a bronco. Not that I've ever done that, but that's an image that people seem to like to use. And again, in traditional texts, they say the mind is like a monkey jumping around here and there. They also, there's a line or a verse in one of the books we published that's from a traditional text that says, the mind is like a wild elephant, and you need to train it so that it's not so wild, so that it will follow your direction. But here we're saying something different, I think, or TSK is saying something different. It's saying, okay, so the mind is moving along, it jumps here, it jumps there, it goes here, it goes there. Can we just follow along? Can we just be the rider, skillfully staying mounted on the horse? And then I suppose what happens after a while is the horse does begin to calm down, the mind does begin to calm down, so then the two things come together. But really, the part that where my sense is that there's so much to learn is that when we set out to do a practice like this and we say, okay, I'm going to stay focused on what my experience is in this moment, or I'm going to be present to experience, or I'm going to engage the temporal dynamic, that's really the language we've been using, we can do it for a little bit and then we can't anymore. And The question is, why is that? What's going on? Especially because when we do that, when we're successful in doing that, it feels very positive. It feels very rich and alive. So that, I think, is an underlying concern that I have here. And the more we've worked with this material, the more that I've realized that that is kind of the big question that, for me, experientially, as we work with this material. Many years ago, I read a book by a student of Gurdjieff called In Search of the Miraculous. And I mean, this was many years ago. But one thing in that book, I think it was that one, stuck with me. People are gathered together in a room, and they go around in a circle, and they say, what is the one thing you really want to know? And Uspensky says, the one thing I really want to know is, why do we forget? Why do we forget things? And somehow that seemed to me to be a really important question. And what I'm saying now is related to that, although I think it goes to something more significant, which is something like, why do we forget from moment to moment? You know, why do we forget to be present from moment to moment? Let's say it that way. So there's two ways you could look at that, one or two ways you could explore that. One is really to ask that why question, and that would be asking for an explanation, which in my experience is not so helpful, because maybe you come up with the perfect explanation, but it doesn't change things. The other way would be to really develop ways of not forgetting, of being present, that are effective over time, you know, that really let us stay with our experience in a different way. And that seems like a really noble goal, in the sense that if we could do that, our lives would be completely different. Now, Christopher, in his post, actually talked about that a little bit. He was talking about doing one of the practices we've been working with, and he said that something really clicked in for him, and he really had the sense of being able to stay with that. And then he said that continues to some extent even now. I had the impression it was a couple of days later or something like that. And that is, you know, and I think somebody else commented on that and said, yes, it was like that for them too. I don't know if it was somebody on this phone call or not. But even if you say, okay, I do a practice and it really helps me stay present, and then that sense of presence is really with me for a while, for a few hours, for a couple of days, but then it disappears again, or it fades away, or it becomes less powerful. And the question is, what's going on and how can we work with it? And if we all set ourselves the goal of trying to cultivate that ability to be present to our own experience, and just stay with that, with, you know, the theoretical end point would be that we were always present to our experience. You know, and when we were planning the future, let's say, or remembering the past, then our experience would be that we were planning the future or remembering the past, but we would be present to it. Whereas what typically happens is we get lost in the content, right? We space out, but that's too strong a term. So anyway, I just wanted to emphasize that central point, because as I say, it's become for me the central point as I do the reading this time. Does anybody want to say anything about that?
Not about staying with it all the time. It's about remembering to return to it, and that we can use our own unhappiness as a signal or a cue to remind us to return to it. So it might be about recultivating it repeatedly rather than trying to stay in it.
Well, that's a good point. That makes sense to me. And the way that I phrased it, it did sound like kind of an all or nothing thing. You know, I'm present and now I'm not, so I've failed. So then I have to deal with the consequences of my sense of failure, and then I have to jump back in. What you're saying is is more realistic, I think. And what you say about using our own unhappiness or frustration maybe as a cue, I think that's really nice too. Of course, there's a kind of a circle there, because in order to be aware of our own unhappiness, we have to be tuned into our experience. But I guess in part what you're saying is that our unhappiness has a certain power and dynamic of its own, so that it's a good tool, it's a good reminder that we're not, that something's going on that could be different. Is that fair?
That we're knowing of this in a painful way.
Yeah, right. So the pain itself becomes a way of waking up. That makes good sense to me. Anybody else?
Oh, yes, there's a keyboard with this here, Arthur.
Yeah.
This is a painful way. Sometimes I have had the experience, it seems to me as if there was a jump from the future to the past and crossing my presence. So I remembered in the 50s and 60s on the first generation of TV, when the picture was running from the top further down and you couldn't see the pictures. It was so quick. So in my experience, the thoughts sometimes I couldn't keep. And
right. I let me just translate if I understand correctly. I don't mean I think I understand what you're saying, but first of all, a lot of people won't remember that. And second, I had to think for a moment. The way we used to talk about that in English anyway was the vertical stability, right? The picture was not stable vertically.
Yes, I understand, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, and that's what you're talking about, right? The picture went by, you know, it's like instead of stabilizing in the middle of the screen, it just kept running down and running down. I think that's a very nice image for people, at least for people who had that experience.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So sometimes it is very frustrating or painful. So I cannot say what is coming into the presence. It is so, the movement is so quick. It seems to me, it is so quick, so it is over. I cannot see and keep the flow, the process.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, that suggests something interesting, which is that if we're trying to move that quickly, and maybe my image of a wild horse or a wild elephant is not the right image for that reason. If we say, oh, it's, everything moves so quickly and somehow I have to learn to move that quickly too in order to stay on top of it, maybe we can't really do that because it moves so quickly. So maybe that may be one reason that part of our exploration here, part of our inquiry, is understanding time differently. Because if your sense of time is that it's one moment after another, that contributes to the sense that everything is changing so quickly that it perhaps is even impossible. But if your sense of time is that there's just a dynamic that you can tune into, then there may be something different. There's another image that people use sometimes. Again, something I have no experience of, but at least I've seen pictures of, is when you're surfing on the ocean, right? And there's this incredible force. The waves are just coming really quickly and so on. But if you catch the waves, that's the image that's used, then you find yourself in this kind of wonderful dynamic stillness.
Yeah.
So that would be another image. Now, how helpful those images are, I'm not sure, but at least they may give us a sense. Mm-hmm. So When Rinpoche, at the start of this chapter, we're starting with the future infinitive, right, the chapter 11, he starts this chapter by talking about being able to tune in to the power of time, and he says that, you know, there are moments when we do that. And the examples that he gives, they're both positive and negative, but the ones that seem, the ones he goes into just a little in that first paragraph are more positive. You know, we're in the middle of something very stressful, and suddenly there is that sense of, as he says here, an almost overwhelming sense of aliveness. And he talks about great joy. He does also talk about great sorrow. So he's talking about moments when that sort of thing comes up, times of vitality. And he talks about time then as this, these were the words, a thrusting, driving presence. But it strikes me, you know, if we cultivate extreme moments like that, which would be one way to try to proceed, and my own sense is that people do try to do that, surfing is a good example. You know, why do people surf or do similar kinds of activities? Again, I haven't done it, but my guess is that they're looking for those moments, those special moments, when they catch the wave, and then they're there in the middle of experience in a very dynamic and alive way. And it's exactly that aliveness that makes them want to do it again. Mm-hmm. Or if you're, there's a lot of sports like that, you know, mountain climbing. Or so moments when you feel like you really are present and alive. But if we're going to make that a practice, or if we're going to try to have it affect our everyday lives, I think we need to cultivate something less dramatic. So at the end of the second paragraph on page 91, Rinpoche talks about shifting shapes unfolding in unbroken presentation. It's one of those phrases that is really nice to say in English, at least comes nicely off my tongue. But so you have to be careful to actually listen to what it's saying. He's saying, instead of the interaction of identified entities, which is the way we ordinarily understand things, you know, there's one moment with one content, and then there's the next moment with the next content, and the content has been identified, and the moments interact with each other. He says, instead of that, there's this other sense of shifting shapes and an unbroken presentation. So kind of a flow, another way of saying that would be to talk about a flow. And so, you know, we've been trying to do that. We've been looking at how the future arrives. And we've been looking at how the past presents the present. You know, those moments, and really you could say what we're trying to do is when we look at those meeting places of past and present, or future and present, is we're challenging this sense of identified entities and seeing if we can replace it with a sense of shifting shapes unfolding in unbroken presentation. That's exactly where we are. That really is where this chapter is going, and it's saying, let's look at that in terms of the future. And at the very bottom of page 91, he talks about that. He says we can invite such experience into our lives by focusing on the unshaped possibilities of the future. And he says on you know, when you do that, if that's what you're doing, then the real, and I'm quoting again on page 92, he says, the real remains unfounded, right? Whatever it is that we accept as the reality of the situation is there, and it has its reality, but that reality is unfounded. Because one way of saying that is that in the next moment, in the future, it could all be completely different. The possible persists as possible. So, you know, if you just look in terms of practical or let's say everyday experience, that's not our experience, because whatever's going on in this moment continues in the next moment. And in Love of Knowledge, Rinpoche writes that that's our tendency. We operate on the assumption that everything stays the same except the things that we have to acknowledge as being different. So it's like in a when you're drawing cartoons, when you're doing animation for a film, I have read in the past that if you had to redraw each frame, of course they do it differently now with computers, but if you're doing it by hand, if you had to redraw each frame, that would be incredibly time consuming. But what they do is they repeat the frame and then they just change the things that have changed in the next frame. So there's this underlying sameness, and then just the changes that we, in a way you could say, that we have to acknowledge. That's how we ordinarily do it. But what's being suggested here is that if our focus is on the future, and in a sense the future here is just a gateway, you could say, to the dynamic of time. It's a gateway because it's the place where things are, remain possible, where things have not been identified, have not been given a solid substance or reality. So if you can put the future at the center of your experience instead of the past, which is what we ordinarily do, then that commitment that we make to sameness, which is the commitment really to what is not affected by time, gives way to a kind of involvement with the dynamic of time. So one way to think about that, and I don't think Rinpoche says it exactly that way, but one way to think about that is that when we do it that way, we're not looking at what's experienced, but we're looking at the experience, or even the experience is not quite right. You could say we're looking at experience. Typically, what we do is, again, we identify what's happened and we say, I just experienced this. And it automatically puts us in the past tense, right? We've identified it. It's the happened. It's what we experienced. But if we look at the ongoing experience, that's more the dynamic. So that's another way to look at it. We look from the experiential side, and experience itself remains unfounded. So I think what Rinpoche is, well, let me stop there and ask, see if there's any people have any comments or questions, or does this all seem, you know, maybe it seems fairly clear what I'm saying now because we've been exploring this for a while. Anybody want to say anything?
Yes, I have a question.
Yes.
Because I have been listening to you not only in this lecture or gathering, but even in the past 3, 4, 5, whatever, meaning this quarter, that is my first one in TSA, I keep intuitively, I think I connect all of this material to the way of being present in the moment. And, you know, I've been learning it through other angles at the Institute, you know, through Kune, through various ways that I can right now think of. And this is a very new angle. What keeps coming to my mind to say, but the whole underlying mud that is preventing us or me to be able to do that is the thickness of the emotion, the poisonous emotion that is so thick, and I get so identified and I get lost in it. And that has to spin out, the mud has to spin out by merit and wisdom and da 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 da, the way I understand it. But from what I'm hearing, there is no mention of that in any of these materials. And Am I missing, or am I the, or are they being very optimistic in this book and this vision that there is a possibility that you could jump into this presentness without even with bypassing the emotionality altogether? Can you shine some light for me in this particular
Yes, thank you, Sudipa. That's really well put. And I think it's a question people have a lot if they come to the TSK vision with some kind of background in Buddhism or perhaps other spiritual traditions. So I'm going to paraphrase a little what you said and then try to respond. And I think what your intuition, as you say, I think is fundamentally right. But let me see if I can clarify it a little bit. So you're saying that especially in this, what we're dealing with right now is time. And of course, the TSK vision has these three different facets. But right now, we're looking at it in terms of time. And there is the sense of immediate presence in TSK. And the aliveness of time is you could also speak of that as immediate presence. And what you're saying is that in Buddhist teachings, the underlying assumption, or the way of describing experience is that we are really caught up in our emotionality, and that in order to be able to cut through that and be able to arrive at this very other experience, this very different experience of presence, there are practices that we need to do and ways in which we need to transform our way of engaging experience. And at least two of them, which you mentioned, are accumulating merit and accumulating wisdom. And in Buddhism, that's what you say. If you want to make progress on the path, you have to accumulate merit and you have to accumulate wisdom. And so your intuition was that in TSK, since those things aren't talked about, there's a way of kind of jumping directly into presence rather than laying out or practicing the kind of path that Buddhism presents. And I think that's exactly right. The focus on emotionality is certainly something that comes up repeatedly in the TSK books. Emotionality here is just a kind of summary term for our ordinary way of experiencing, which is driven by a commitment to the self and driven by and manifests, you could say, then in emotionality. And I think what the TSK vision says is instead of transforming our emotionality, there is a way in which we can transform, and the words here are always difficult to find, but there is a way in which we can transform our way of engaging our own being. And the facets of our own being that we want to engage are time and space and knowledge. So we're looking now at time, and what's being said is that if we can cut through our mistaken perception of time and experience time differently, experience the dynamic of time directly, then all of the products of our usual way of understanding, our usual way of experiencing time, which include emotionality and include a fixation on the self and so on, all of those will just, you could say, almost automatically drop away. I do think that's what the TSK vision is saying. And so, no, you don't accumulate merit. You don't, in a sense, you could say, you don't accept our ordinary view. The thing about the kinds of teachings, and Buddhism has lots of different levels and different levels of teachings, but if we focus on this particular dimension or level, the idea of accumulating merit and wisdom is based on a model something like this. We have this mistaken way of being and we need to transform it. And we have, in order to set about transforming it, we accumulate merit, we accumulate wisdom, and over time or at a certain point, however you want to think about it, a transformation takes place. But in TSK, the idea is that we have never engaged a mistaken way of being. All we have is a very limited understanding of our own being. It's not real, and therefore it doesn't need to be transformed. And of course, there are Buddhist teachings which say similar things, but nonetheless, in Buddhism, there's a path, and they always say, you know, the view is one thing, but you have to practice the path. And in TSK, there is this sense that the view and this particular way of engaging our being through time and space and knowledge is itself a path. If you can transform the view, then you don't need to do anything else, and you don't need to engage in a traditional path. Now, that doesn't mean that it's all a question of conceptual insight, not at all. And I think we've been doing this enough so that we understand that. The way to transform our understanding of time, which again is our focus right now, that's exactly what we've been looking at and what I was talking about at the beginning of our phone call here. It has to do with learning to experience or engage time differently. Not just conceptually, but really working with it in very specific ways. So you could say that the TSK vision offers its own path, but it's a path that has to do with really experiencing differently. And the idea is that we can do that. We really can do that. Yeah. You're welcome. It's a big topic, but I think it's good to step back and ask those questions from time to time. Okay, well, let me see where we can go with this. I don't think we want to take too much more time looking at the specifics of the chapter. One way to think about this chapter is that, and you could say this whole section of this book and certain and various parts of the TSK books, is that what they're trying to do is evoke this different way of being. And it's almost like poetry. You know, it would be a nice exercise, or maybe something that happens naturally as you're reading, if you're reading slowly and with appreciation, certain phrases stand out for you. And it's not that they say something different from other parts of the chapter, but they hit you in a certain way. You connect with them in a certain way. And it might be a nice exercise to really read the chapter slowly and with appreciation, or do next week's reading, and just look for the ways of expression that really touch something in you, and let yourself savor that feeling, because that itself is a way of practicing. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples that just struck me in this reading. On page 95, Rinpoche talks about, he says, a vast mystery offers an unknown knowledge. I think that's a lovely phrase, and it's actually very rich and requires a lot of thinking. Well, maybe thinking isn't the right word. It requires a lot of appreciation. A vast mystery offers an unknown knowledge. But that's just something that strikes me. There may well be other things that strike you. But he does have this sense, or he does suggest, that the way to approach all of this is with an active sense of not knowing, right? And that not knowing is related to something else he mentions in this reading, which is gratitude. You know, not to know. What expresses our highest aspirations, which is a phrase on page 96, and a sense of gratitude. So, you know, it cannot be, and we just talked about this, but let me come back to it. It cannot be a conceptual move. You know, it's not enough to say, oh, I see so clearly now that time can't possibly be this moment-to-moment kind of unfolding, and the present can't be this little point instant, and all of these things that we've been exploring. It's not enough if you say, I understand that clearly. The question is, how does it enter into your life? And one of the answers that Rinpoche gives here is on page 96, where he talks about expressing our highest aspiration. Let's see, where is it? Yeah. He says, at the bottom of page 95, he says, without ever taking form, the unrestricted dynamic of future time manifests in the non-arising of obstacles that might hinder the coming to the present of events in time. Now, if we were doing another phone call right after this one, I think I'd try to spend some time really unpacking that phrase, because there's a lot there. But we have to move on. The non-arising of obstacles, that's the unrestricted dynamic of future time. Time presents experience in a perfect neutrality, allowing for boundless possibilities, including those that express our highest aspirations. And although he doesn't say it specifically here, it does seem to me that one safeguard to keep yourself from getting caught in a conceptual understanding is to try to let yourself be aware of your own highest aspirations and then see what is the dynamic or aliveness within those aspirations. If you tune in at that level, I think you're coming closer, you're coming very close to the heart of what the vision is about. Okay, any comments or questions arising out of that? Because otherwise we're about done.
Maybe next time you can address that. It seems to me you still have something superimposing on the unfolding of the possibilities, even though one may assign high aspirations, but nevertheless, it's almost like expectation is too strong, but there is a layer you overlay.
So you're saying that aspirations can become a way of imposing your own view of what matters on this unfolding dynamic of time, right? Is that do I understand you correctly?
And then that kind of contradicts to be totally open.
Mm-hmm. I tell you what, why don't you post something online that raises that question? And we'll see what people have to say, and I'll have something to say about it too. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's stop there. I will put some guidance up. We're finishing up the chapter for next week. And as I said at the beginning, I'm more and more clear for myself anyway that the thrust of what we're doing is wanting to be able to move into a deeper and more pervasive relationship to the dynamic of time. And I originally expressed that as continuing to remain within that dynamic. Hayward, I think it was, said, maybe more accurately or realistically, learning to use our own experience of pain or unhappiness as an indicator that we are not in contact with that dynamic. So those are two very interesting, I think that's a helpful addition, and I think those may give us some clues, but I'll say some more in the guidance.